little third-party intervention. There was very little things that came between you and the patient. I mean, you know, we worked, and we worked hard. All of us enjoyed a good practice. Compared to now, there were very few physicians to take care of the troops. Granted, there weren't as many people here, but at the same time, there are more doctors to take care of what people there are now than there were more people now than there were in those days. Mm-hmm. And so, consequently, if you liked what we're doing, and most of us did in those days, you were happy, and you felt like you were contributing something, and your patients were your friends, and you felt like you were respected. I don't mean you felt like you were God or anything like that, because you weren't, you know, and we knew we weren't. But at least you medicine had some aura of respect and dedication to it, you know. Granted, I guess.
How did patients pay you in those days?
Oh, they paid us. They paid us and paid us very well. They also felt obligated to you for some reason, because they liked you and they trusted you. I remember, for instance, in those days we made so many house calls. And it wasn't uncommon to where you go and make a house call and you see somebody in the home that was sick. And they'd say, "All right now." You'd say, "All right now. Well, you know, I'm gonna phone in this prescription for you, and I'll do it right now, or we'll give you this this medicine, and I want you to call me in 2 days or tomorrow, or something like that, or I'll be back to see him tomorrow." See, and so you get ready to leave, and they'd say, "Just a minute, doctor. I've made something for you, pie." Or I have some pie and some coffee for you, or here's a hot meal for you, you know, if it's late at night or something like that. And people always bring you things. In this area where we practice, there were a lot of truck farmers out here, and they used to, well, I still have one guy that brings me a lot of fruit and stuff like that, vegetables and everything all the time, in big boxes.
So you felt very cared for and cherished by people.
Oh yeah, sure, sure. You really did. I did in those days, and I think I'm talking to my own colleagues. They felt the same thing.
And you think some of
we don't feel that way now.
You don't.
Oh yeah, sure. No, we don't feel that way now. Very, to a greater extent, because there's still some of those people in the Heights area or around. We still treat some of those people. Or we still treat some of those people's families. But by and large, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm. What happened? First of all, how do you feel, and what happened along the way?
Well, I think there were things to come. First of all, there were such things as Medicare, and leading up to what is now like the DRGs and things like that, insurance companies with reports after reports and red tape and length of stay and before long we were having everybody dictating to us what we were to do, mm-hmm. in the care of the patient.
Excuse my ignorance, because you know I'm 35, but when I was young, did people have medical insurance, or did you just pay their doctor like you pay your grocer and pay your department store? And
comparatively speaking, very few people had insurance compared to how many people have insurance nowadays. Mm-hmm. Not only that, I think we have raised a public that is consumer conscious, that is suit conscious, that believes they should have something for nothing, believes that and also believe that they are not obligated to take care of their elders, or their mother and their father, and elderly people that raised them. So there are so many ways by which people are taken care of nowadays by the government and third parties and things like that. And
so with the advent of Medicare, that was the beginning of the person intruding into this bond between you and your patient.
I think it was.
So it stepped out, it became a triangle.
I think it was, 1966. In fact, it was so bad that in 1966, I was president of the Harris County Medical Society. And we, a few of us, got together and decided, well, what could we do in order to preserve the doctor-patient relationship? So we got up the individual responsibility program. That was that we said that we were going to practice medicine by not taking assignments. That our contract was directly with that patient. And I would serve that patient, and the patient would pay me. Now, if the patient didn't have any insurance, it's fine. They still had to look for me to pay me. If they had insurance, then the contract was between that patient and their insurance company. It wasn't between me and the insurance company. It had anything to do with the insurance company. My contract was with the patient to take care of them.
Has that remained?
So we would bill that patient. That patient would in turn look to us, but they would submit that bill to the insurance company along with an attending physician statement. The insurance company would pay them, and they would pay us. That was the whole individual responsibility program in a nutshell.
Did it work?
Since 1966, we have not taken any assignments on anyone in our clinic except people who are have died, and that's the only reason that that's the only way that Medicare will pay for those people, you know.
In other words, you've maintained this system.
We've maintained this whole thing since then. We've enjoyed 93 and a 94 and a 95% collection rate with our people all that time. Now, we don't hit anybody over the head for money or anything like that in the clinic. We don't insist that they have the money when they come to see us or anything like that. It's worked very well for us in this community.
How has it, is this common practice in other areas in the city now, or is it
very few?
Send the bill to my insurance company and
very
they'll pay
few.
You?
Yes, right, sure, sure, sure. Or take an assignment. See, doctor takes an assignment of the insurance benefits. So the insurance company pays him. The patient never knows what the insurance company pays. So they're really not responsible. But we made it responsible.
And it benefits.
It's worked out real good.
Strengthens your relationship with them.
Strengthened
too.
Our relationship 100%. It's worked out real good.
So I understand you have this problem of somebody telling you how much your services are worth and all this other stuff when you've got an insurance company.
Sure, that's right. Sure, sure.
Yeah.
So it's worked very well, but that's one of the things that has, now we've kind of preserved that in this area, but now in this area, along with other areas, you know, there are all kinds of alphabet medicine nowadays. So, you know, people are looking for the cheap medical dollar. They're joining HMOs, PPOs, you know, and all kinds of stuff in order to try to get there. Their medicine is at a lowered cost if they can.
What do you mean when you said before 1966 and the advent of Medicaid?
Yeah, Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah. You said we were respected. we were this, we were that. How do you think of yourself today in March of 1985? What's it like for you today?
Well, me?
And your colleagues that you talk to, I'm sure.
Well, I think all of us feel in a way like I do. We are our physicians. We're in more of a business than a profession this day and time. I see the effects of consumerism, you know, just on us all the time. We've got some product to sell, but you know, nowadays a lot of times it's a bad product. I mean, they feel like that. I think, in a large respect, there's still some kind of an adversary feeling between the patient and the doctor. I don't know whether people like doctors anymore. I don't know whether they really trust them. You know, I don't really think they really know anything about them. I think they make more money than they do. Granted, now don't misunderstand me, I think we brought most of this on some, I'd say at least 60% of this on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Medicine has become so geared is that, well, when I first came out here to practice and do general practice, I worked on the emergency room. The emergency room and took a week out of every five, I think, on the emergency room service, where people could come in and see a doctor that was here. Now we've become so specialized, we have emergency room physicians. Well, because the hospitals have become so expensive, and the emergency rooms have had to at least, you know, maybe break even, and medicine has become so specialized and so fantastically mechanized that emergency room visits are so very high. So they've created doc in a box things, emergency room clinics, and things like that. And so the people, and they've been publicized. So they think they're really getting a big deal when they go see them, and it's cheaper than that. And it's really not, but they don't know that for sure. But they do know that the emergency rooms that are connected with the hospitals are the most expensive things in the whole wide world. And they are, so.
But that, the emergency room, in the way you were brought up, probably being treated by doctors, and I was, the emergency room was never intended to be your GP clinic, which it evolved into being.
That's right, sure didn't. And you know, and also for a long time, the emergency rooms became a convenience for people. Doctors' hours got less and less, and people, you know, in order to get some illness taken care of, doctors pretty soon you couldn't find them at night, and they quit making house calls. And medicine got so highly mechanized that house calls became just a goodwill thing in good public relations, and that's all they became after a while, because people expected you to do more for them than just come over and, you know, listen to their chest with a stethoscope and write them a prescription, you know, or give them a shot. They wanted an electrocardiogram and complete blood count and, you know, serum amylase and all kinds of stuff like that.
That may or may not have been necessary to the diagnosis and treatment.
Exactly right, madam, exactly right. So then we've become so, I don't know what medicine, mechanized or something, that people can't see their own doctors except maybe, you know, 2-3 hours during the day, and they've got to go to somebody else. Also, I don't know what's happening to doctors. They They don't work as hard as they used to. They don't spend as much hours working as they used to. Because, you know, night work, unless you're, you know, somebody like myself, is almost unheard of. In this community, our GPs send a patient to the emergency room physician takes care of them. They don't ever have to leave home anymore at night.
Why? Why don't they work anymore at night?
Well, that's because, you know, it's so convenient for them to let somebody else as an emergency either treat the patient or hospitalize that patient and see them the next morning. That's what we've done for ourselves, I think. I mean, that's bad. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's good at all.
There's some other things you said. 60% of the problems we brought on ourselves.
Oh, yeah, well, this is one.
This is
a good example of it.
Do you think the medical profession could have gotten too caught up with high tech and the value of high tech technology?
Oh yes, I think so. I think we've quit examining the patient. I think we've quit, you know, by and large, quit sitting down and talking to the patient and spending some time with the patient and. I think it's too easy to get a CAT scan on a patient nowadays, and also this looks good to the patient. You know, patient wants all these things. They read about all these things. Patients are more informed these days than anything I ever saw in my life. Doctors got to read Good Housekeeping and Vogue and all that stuff in order to really keep up with the things that patients know about.
But I think we've gotten fat.
We, the doctors, have gotten fat.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, we've enjoyed a good life. We've seen a way now and a manner now by which we can work, still make a pretty good living and not exert ourselves too much. We can still spend a lot of more time with our families and at the country club and all kinds of stuff like that. And so, and still make a good living. And so, what the hell? We've quit taking care of the troops, really taking care of them. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I'd like to come back to the role of high technology because I think it is it's going to continue to be a bigger and bigger issue as time marches on because we have technology now that can virtually almost keep anybody alive. And the issue of who lives and who dies and the cost of allowing yourself to be hooked up to the technology versus maybe doing a very, very super thorough physical and history and you relying on your intuition to tell you what's really the matter with this person. Has technology, in a sense, taken over the doctor? Taken over his role, and who's the god of the technology as far as telling you what it really can and can't do?
Well, I think, first of all, I think a lot of doctors have become servants of the technology. Yes, you're right, I sure do. And I think also patients, in a way, have become servants of it because it's exotic, it's new, it's something that the patients don't really understand and they think it's the last word, and it's not. And so they become, you'd be surprised how many people come in and say, you don't know what's the matter with me, why don't you run a CAT scan on me? You know? I mean, you know, that's right.
And the CAT scan's not going to tell them anymore.
No, ma'am, it's not. But you know, with it, you know, and they will go home now, I got a CAT scan in my head, you know. But anyway, also, nobody's supposed to die nowadays. Think about that for a minute.
I know it. I think it's a big problem.
Oh, it's a big problem. Listen,
Europeans.
You ought to treat them. I'll tell you, you ought to treat them. You ought to have to treat the patients. You ought to have to treat mama and operate on mama. And then face the family and say, you know, I can't do anything for mama and can't do anything more for mama. And many times when you don't know these people, they don't know you, and they say, I want a second opinion. I don't want mama to lay here and suffer. But nobody's supposed to die nowadays. Also, how...
In America,
that's what I mean.
In other countries, because of the cost of medical care,
sure,
they've cut it off. They've been making some of those decisions.
Well, they're rationing medical care. That's what they're doing in other countries. Now, you want to talk about that, we'll talk about that. But we're not doing that here yet. To a certain extent, we are. We've started doing it since the DRGs came into vogue. We're rationing care to a certain extent.
Okay.
Well, pretty soon, we're going to... See, the government hadn't got enough money to finance Medicare. They never have had. They thought they had, but they don't have. And now it's getting more and more expensive. And so it costs more money all the time. And people are living longer now. What is it, you know, by the year 2000, I think that the people over 80 years of age, I think, will be the oldest. There'll be more of those people than there will be any other age group in the United States.
It won't be long before my generation will make a fifth of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I think the generation above me, a fifth of the population, will be over the age of 65.
Sure.
And I think because the baby boomers are growing older, now there's this great preoccupation with caring for the elderly.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know,
sure.
Who up till now we've just been dumping and warehousing. Now all of a sudden our generation's looking to being old. Oh my gosh, now we need geriatric psychiatry, we need lovely nursing homes.
That's right, we do. We need all those things. Sure we do. Sure we do. Sure. And not only that, again, nobody's supposed to die. Everybody's supposed to live. And you're supposed to, the doc's supposed to do everything he can for them. The patients insist. Not only that, when you don't do everything you can for them, or when there's some difference in opinion, or when the patient's family think you're doing exactly right, that's when you get sued. And we know that. And a lot of times we do nothing but what we call defensive medicine. A patient now, for instance, that comes in the emergency room at our hospital will get 27% of her bill will be due to nothing but defensive medicine. That's tests that have been ordered in order to cover your tracks if you go to court. Now that's bad, but that's just the way it is. You know, everybody's afraid of getting sued, and nobody wants to be sued.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, the sad thing, too, is that system now is set up such that you can sue your doctor, and of course, he can't sue you back for doing it.
No.
Until the whole thing, you know, is finished. Why don't lawyers get sued, I wonder?
Well, they do, more and more. More and more nowadays. God love them. Their malpractice insurance is increasing and increasing, and there are more suits, lawyers, nowadays than there ever has been, and they're on uprise all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Glad to have them in the fold. Glad to have them in the fold.
You've mentioned several times the idea of nobody can die.
Right.
Should we be rationing medical care in this country, and how should we be doing it? Do the Europeans have a good way of doing it?
No, ma'am. I don't think they have. I don't know the answer to rationing care. And I don't know, when you say ration care, it's not like rationing, you know, groceries. You're talking about rationing human life. And not only are you talking about rationing human life, but you're talking about the morbidity that goes with it all of not taking care of someone or not doing what you should for someone. You know, over in England, for instance, you wait 3 years to get your hernia fixed. You wait 2 years to get your coronary arteries bypassed. You have to be a certain age before you can, or under a certain age before you can get your coronary arteries bypassed. So what they're doing is letting people die that are a certain age, and they've all said this is what they're going to do. All right, because they don't have money enough to take care of them. Okay, but now that's just fine, except when it's your mother or your father or when it's you. I mean, you know, the age cuts off at 60 for instance, for no more coronary artery bypasses. But what if you're 61 years old, you know? You've got angina so bad you can't see straight.
But where's the bottom line? We have a technology in this country that can sustain life at an incredibly high cost to everybody involved, the hospitals to buy the stuff, the doctors to operate it. You have this specialization to, you know, to mind-boggle you. I probably, you know, a lot of the doctors can't keep up with all the subspecializations. Is the bottom just going to drop out of the whole thing, where it'll just get to be a point where you just simply can't afford a medical care, and that's when you're going to die?
Well, I think maybe something like that ought to happen. Frankly, I don't know what's going to happen, but the government made a mistake when they said they were going to, when they passed the Medicare law, Medicare and Medicaid, until 1819. Passed the law. They passed those laws. They had no idea what it would cost. They had no idea how they'd be extended. And now they're trying to do something with it in order to cut the cost. And what they're doing is that the only way they can do it is to do it like with the DRGs now and the PROs. Maybe something like this will work, but maybe there's got to be some sort of a means test about who gets medical care. I mean, you know, the millionaire who is over 65, he doesn't have to pay anything more for his medical care than somebody who is, you know, who makes $30,000 a year. There's got to be some means test someplace with all this. I mean, you just can't give everybody the same thing. Well, they didn't do that with the income tax. Why they do it with health care? You see what I mean?
I think it's a very important point.
Well, I don't know. I've thought a lot about it because I've held a lot of offices in medical organizations, and when you have that capability and you're in that position, you try to figure out things, and so, you know, most of us are inadequate to figure them out. But the government's got, and also politicians, we've got to have politicians who don't keep extending things in order to get votes. Mm-hmm.
Should we have had nationalized medicine?
Yes.
They say it would have kept the health care costs down better than any other thing. At least that's what Paul Storer says in his book,
that's
Socialization
exactly right.
Of America.
Yes, I heard that he said that. Well, England's got nationalized medicine. If all you have to do is just investigate it or read about it, and you find out you don't want it because it's rationing health care. And I don't think rationing health care is the answer. I just don't think you can put everybody under one age group and say, this age group gets their kidneys dialyzed, and this age group can't have any dialysis. And that's what's happening over in England. And also, when you do this sort of thing and the money goes, then, you know, where any improvements in hospitals have been over in England?
Where? I don't know.
They haven't been with the national health scheme. There have been no improvements. You know, they've got about one CAT scan forever.
Yeah, oh, it's the most technologically void atmosphere I've ever been in.
That's exactly right. All right. Okay. But now private industry, American industry, hospital, investor-owned. Oh, healthcare is a big business. Medicine's not a big business. See what I mean? I mean, don't confuse medical care with healthcare.
Okay, differentiate them
for me. Well, you know, I'm a doctor and I give medical care. For instance, doctor's fees haven't risen like hospital costs have risen. Now, people confuse and they say, you know, medical care when you mean healthcare. I give medical care, mm-hmm. but, you know, and I'm one of the healthcare professionals in this country. But, you know, healthcare or hospital care, here's where all the rise in healthcare cost is. And this is because high technology, labor. God knows, these people that run the CAT scan, they're well trained, and they command a big salary. And it's that way with the people that run the ultrasounds. Nurses nowadays are finally realizing at least, you know, maybe what they should have been paid a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But labor is a big cost in hospitals, and most people don't understand that. But it really is. Big, big, big percentage of the cost of hospitals. Mm-hmm. And medical care, doctor's fees, they haven't risen like hospital costs have. But hospital costs, you know, they're really so high. And this is what people...
Yeah, and you don't really see a decline in the labor aspect of it, in that you're going to need somebody to run the heart-lung machine and a coronary bypass. And so the labor is not going to decline even with the increase of technology.
No, I don't think it is. And for instance, although slowly, nurses, laboratory technicians, all different aspects of hospital employees are beginning to unionize. And when this happens, you know, pretty well, totally, then you're going to continue to see the labor cost rise and, in fact, you know, get an astronomical amount. Mm-hmm. Never going to get any lower.
Mm-hmm. Probably a lot of the teamsmanship among these individuals, the doctor, the nurse, the lab person, probably a lot of that has fragmented too. So there's perhaps an adversary relationship between these groups now, or it's you're more isolated from one another, more separated?
I don't think so. No, I don't. Well, the hospitals, for instance, has become more departmentalized, if that's what you mean. But there's still teams that do things. There are cardiac teams, there are kidney dialysis teams, there are ICU, CCU teams.
Well, how about the changing relationship of the doctor-nurse from the early days?
You know, well, that's the same thing.
The same?
You know, it's not the same. It's not the same. But there again, you know, there are a lot of causes for this, I think. But the nurse has really become a professional. In a way, nurses have become practitioners. In fact, they're nurse practitioners, so certified, and Medicare pays them mm-hmm. for their work. But nurses are demand more salary. They demand more in the position of health care than they used to. There again is a whole big problem that most people don't even know about. But it has also caused the hospital patients' care from the hospital standpoint, nursing standpoint, to become more impersonalized. There's less bedside nursing going on nowadays. We who work in hospitals constantly see this. The patient is more computerized.
Isolated. Press a button and get a light if you want a human being to come into the room.
That's right. And there's less attention to that patient. I mean, human attention to that patient. There's less emphasis taught on bedside nursing than there used to be. Mm-hmm. Used to be bedside nursing. You know, I mean, a nurse who can really nurse at the bedside, you know, do the things that nurses should be. But no, they're more chiefs and less Indians than they used to be as far in a nursing profession. Mm-hmm. The nurses have demanded that nurses become more educated now. And when they become more educated, then they want to be the chiefs, not the Indians. So we're having less of the Indians and more of the chiefs nowadays. Mm. And the patient suffers from that.
All right, it is Thursday, March the 14th, 1985, and we'll continue this interview with Dr. Miley Durham. All right, we're going to pick up this interview at where Dr. Miley Durham got out of the Korean War, and we're going to direct the next part of the interview to organized medicine. Why the term organized medicine?
Well, I agree with you. You know, that's no cliche. It should be disorganized medicine, because you've got a group of doctors trying to, in an organization, trying to do what the organization says it will do, and so consequently, you know, doctors can't agree on anything, and so they never get together on anything. So consequently, that's another old cliche. Small groups run organizations in medicine. I don't know about it the real world, but in medicine, that's what happens. The workers get together, and the people that will work and will meet, and they're the people that do all the work. They're the cliche that everybody says runs organized medicine in certain either medical societies or state medical associations or even the AMA, mm-hmm. House of Delegates. Anyway, when I got out of the Army,
What year are we talking about?
I got out of the Army in 1953 and came back in practice. I could tell that my father, who had always been an organizational man as far as medicine was concerned and worked in organizations, and I could tell by the glint in his eye he wanted me to start working in the Harris County Medical Society. So that's what I did. I told them I wanted a job, and they appointed me to a job. And finally, I worked my way into getting elected to the, at that time, legislative board and the public relations board of the medical society were all combined into one. And so I was elected to that a position on that combined board, and subsequently became its chairman. And I also, after I served a time on that board, I was elected to serve on the executive board of the Harris County Medical Society, and which was very fascinating to me. I really thought I got to see how organized medicine worked. You'll find that any organization such as a county medical society or a state medical association or subsequently the American Medical Association all speak they're the either the local organization or the state organization, and they speak for that county or that state. And all the other quasi-medical organizations or any other organization don't speak for that county or that state. And so then I was doing general practice at the time, and I had my father and myself, Dr. Adamo, and my brother had formed the Durham Clinic in the Heights. The Heights area in the north side was getting larger. We were getting more practice. We needed a surgeon to come out here in this part of town. So we all got together, and they asked me if they would finance me, would I leave my practice and go out to the medical center and take a four-year surgery residency. So that's what I did. I went out to Herman Hospital, which at that time was a teaching hospital by itself, sole teaching hospital. And the surgery department was headed by a man that I had the utmost respect and admiration for, George Waldron. And so that was the reason I went out there. And serving on the executive board, there were two physicians on the executive board that were both surgeons that were headed the staff of out there with Dr. Waldron on Herman Hospital. And I constantly fought with those two doctors.
Why?
Well, because their views, I didn't think coincided with mine as far as the way the medical society ought to go. I felt they were too liberal in their views, and they wanted to do some things that I didn't think a medical society ought to do.
What were some of those things?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Being the only county medical society, or the county medical society here, there are certain things in city government that affect the medical posture of that of the county, and one of the things that affected our relationship with the city was that they wanted to move the city and county hospital. Or they wanted to build a new city county hospital, and they wanted to build it adjacent. They wanted to build it in the medical center. And I, along with a group of other doctors in the city, felt like that they should build it adjacent to Jeff Davis Hospital. There's plenty of room on Buffalo Bio, and it ought to be there. And so.
It wasn't built there, though, was
these
it?
Two people, these two doctors who I fought with about other matters, such as publicity for physicians, and in those days, advertising and things like that, they were a little bit more liberal than I was, and so, sure enough, no, it was not built there, to answer your question. It was built out in the medical center. But anyway, that's just one of the things you asked me. As things came up, I found I was on the conservative side of the fence of most things in medicine, and they were two doctors that were on the, mm-hmm. the liberal side.
Let's talk about the idea of publicity, and what year was this?
That was in 56.
Okay, let's talk about the idea, but particularly because it's 1985, and a lot of places are doing whatever they can to get the healthcare dollar, producing television news segments and advertisements and anything else they can do. What was the idea about publicity in those times?
Well, in those days, it was very strict as far as most of us were concerned. Ethics said, for instance, that you did not advertise, or at least if you did advertise, you advertised in such a manner that you were only advertising your name, and if you were new in practice, you advertised your address and your office hours and your immediate qualifications as far as a specialty was concerned, and that's all. But there really wasn't much of that in those days. It, most any kind of advertising was self-aggrandizement as far as you being a doctor and you putting yourself forward by saying that you could cure people, you could do things that other people could not do, getting your name in a newspaper as a doctor and with your specialty attached to it, things like that. In those days, were frowned on completely.
What is the view today?
Well, the view is just exactly, almost opposite. Due to the fact that the Federal Trade Commission has invaded our organizations and told our organizations that if our organizations censored anybody that did advertise, that it would be a violation of restraint, that it would be restraint of trade, and that they would be fined and everything else. So, it's so different nowadays that the AMA even had to change their ethics. Medical organizations for years have lived by in order to comply with the wishes of the Federal Trade Commission as far as advertising and things like that were concerned. So,
what did you think about that hospital being built where it was?
Well, the same thing I thought about then that I think now, it's in the wrong place. If all one has to do is try to get to the hospital at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, or at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and they'll certainly agree with me, really, because the whole traffic pattern's wrong, and it's just not a place out there. And also, we see something else now. It's created a lot of furor because that hospital, due to the fact that Baylor University College of Medicine was here first, they are the people that solely staff the Bentall Hospital. University of Texas Medical School is now here, a branch. The University of Texas is here, medical school is here. By contract, they can't go over there now because Baylor has sewed it up and has become so politically tied to it besides that.
It's Baylor's teaching hospital.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
And of course, the UT residents have had the pleasure of working at Sully at Herman Hospital.
Yes, ma'am, sure, where it's really not
clinical
city county hospital, so-called, and the clinical experience is somewhat limited compared to what at least it was at first. With any large city county hospital such as Bentall, trauma is the big word over there, and that's the majority of those patients, and critically ill patients and trauma patients. Due to the fact of the ingenuity of Herman and the University of Texas with their life flight, they're getting a lot of the trauma patients now. But it's only because they had to work and do everything else to try to get some of the trauma and get some of the patients that.
What have you thought about the Herman scandal, so to speak, in terms of the effect it will have on the health care situation there, as far as do you think it'll affect the standard of health care and things coming in there later on?
No, ma'am, I do not. I don't think it will at all.
Why not?
Well, I think that when you take a scandal such as this, I think it's far removed from the everyday
delivery of health care.
The everyday delivery of health care, sure. Mm-hmm. I think it's just it's totally different. I don't think it's going to impact on it at all.
Mm-hmm. You wanted to talk more about organized medicine, and when you got on these committees at the Harris County Medical Society, and you were president, right, of the president-elect of the Texas Senate?
What I did was what I was going to say was that when I went over to Herman, these two surgeons that I had fought with and I felt like didn't like me very much, and which was wrong, they did, but I found out later on. But I had to have some recommendations of people to recommend me for my residency over there. So I went to these two people and asked them to recommend me, and so they felt kind of bound to do so. So because they'd known me and everything, and they knew what I was, and so I felt like that as long as they would recommend me and sign my recommendation or sign my application recommending me, that they wouldn't give me any trouble during my residency over there. And so they didn't. You know, they were helpful to me and, you know, really taught me a whole lot and helped me a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went to Herman. I spent 4 years. I resigned from all my medical politics, and I liked it very much. Going back to school, so to speak, and learning process. But at the same time, I missed very much working in medical organizations.
What was it about them that intrigued you and challenged you and taught you something you didn't know?
Well, I think it's like anything else. The more you work in an organization, the more you learn. As far as I'm concerned, I feel like that you don't learn as much as, you learn more than you really get accomplished in any organization. I don't care whether you're the leader of that organization or whether you're the lowest person on the totem pole in that organization. You learn more, I think, than you do. I think organizations give more to anybody working in them than they take away from that person, or that person really gives to that organization. I've always felt like that. I think, for instance, it's a learning process. Medicine is something I think that is like a religion to me. I mean, I sincerely believe in it. I believe in it's good. I believe it can do so many things because it reaches so many people. I believe a doctor can do so many things because he reaches so many people. I think medical organizations that insist on good quality and insist on being the organization that guides its members into that organization's purpose, whether it be scientific or whether it be socioeconomic or whether it be a political, I think they all do good organizations. With respect to medicine, I think they all do good, and I think they all help and increase the standards of everybody that works in that organization. So when I came out of my residency, I started working again in the Harris County Medical Society. And it was ultimately in 1966, its president. And I am the only son of a president of the Harris County to be president so far. Mm-hmm. And my father was president in 1946, and I was president in 1966, mm-hmm. 20 years later.
You made some comment about what you learned from organized medicine or the surprises in it compared to just being out in the trenches as a, you know, general practitioner. What was it about it in that time that...
Well, medical organizations in the 50s and early 60s were much more effective and I feel like much more important and did more important work than they're doing now.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? Tell me about the work.
I think that because of the advent of the government in medicine and the Federal Trade Commission, especially in medicine, and the economics of the whole country. I think medicine has really suffered, probably as much or more than any other profession in this country. Medicine, people for some reason have lost a lot of respect for medicine. I think they had much more respect for doctors and for medicine as a whole than in the 50s, 40s and 50s and even 60s than they do now.
Do you think that loss of respect is justified?
Well, I think to a certain extent it is, yes, I
Why?
Do. Well, I think, for instance, we physicians have brought a lot of it on ourselves. I think medical organizations have helped do that as much as the individual physician. But I think the individual physician, let's take him for instance. Medicine has become so specialized and so over-specialized that I think that the primary care physician really doesn't treat a lot of people. I am sure that if they do treat that person, that because medicine has become so specialized and the people have now demanded that they go to some subspecialist all the time for their work, that the relationship between the doctor and the patient, the primary care physician, and that patient is not now like it used to be. That doctor doesn't get close to that patient. The patient doesn't get close to that doctor to know, in a way, what the doctor does and develop the kind of respect for that doctor that they had in the 40s and 50s and 60s and on back yonder. And I think that there's so many, it used to be everybody had their own, well, we call them general practitioners in those days. And the general practitioners did a lot of different kinds of work and did it very well, incidentally. They did OB. They did some surgery. They did most all their internal medicine, at least a great majority of it. They did their pediatrics. The doctor got close to the patient. The patient got close to the doctor. There was a mutual respect. There was a mutual trust. And I feel like that the more that patient knew about that doctor and knew that doctor and knew what the doctor did and how hard he worked and how dedicated he was and how good he was in what he did, they developed the respect for the doctor because they got to know him. You don't get to know your doctor nowadays like you used to. For instance, you don't know just one doctor nowadays like you used to. Due to various things, what is a general practitioner, the family practitioner now? What does he do? He doesn't do very much, you know. In a lot of ways, family practice has just been the man who is the go-between, or who shuffles his patients to the various specialists and subspecialists.
Do you think that with the advent and the advent of specialization, I'll take that first of all. What stimulated that? Was it the status of specialization? Were there outside forces? Was it the technology? Was it too much government intervention to get too many people into the practice of medicine?
Well, I'm always suspicious of the government, first of all. I don't think we just all of a sudden somebody in government or in the legislature came out and said, okay, now we're going to have this competition. Doctors need the competition, and it's going to lower the cost of medicine, and going to make better doctors, and going to make more freedom of choice, and so we're going to have competition. I don't think that happened just overnight, do you?
Oh,
I think
no.
That happened I think this was planned a long time ago. So what I'm talking about is that I think a lot of the things that it's not exactly suffering from, but I think the doctor glut,